kind of strategies do we think might be used to help educate the public about the benefits of Passive House?
That's a good question.
Do
the public understand Passive House? Probably not. Mm-hmm. If you were to say, oh, this school down the road is Passive House, would people understand that? So there's certainly an education gap there that can be filled.
Well, I mean, I think if we could incorporate it into a community's overall sustainability goals, because what we do have now is a next generation of people who I think are much more interested in climate change and sustainability. And then they have this big public building going up in their local area, and there doesn't seem to be a ton of engagement. So perhaps it's just, you know, an education piece that we are going in and talking to these schools, not we, I mean, or well, maybe we, who knows, but the people are going to educate and involve the involvement of the local community. Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for joining our next podcast, which has been recorded up here in Blairgowrie in Scotland from our very own Proctor Pod. Today we're going to be discussing Passive House in public buildings. So hopefully we're going to have quite an informative chat with two fellow Proctor employees. We have Pamela Howitt, who's our senior technical advisor.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Pam. And you've been with us for quite a number of years now.
Yep, almost 23 years now. So.
Goodness me. And we also have Adam Salt, who is our head of global sales modular offsite. Morning, Adam.
Morning, Gira. Morning, everybody. But yeah.
A relatively new role for Adam, but Adam's been looking after our modular sector for about three years now.
Yeah, about 3 years I've been looking after modular. Been at Proctor's for almost 6 years. I've done a range of different roles, different regions, and now looking at the export opportunities. So more learning, new challenges, but yeah, it's all exciting.
Excellent. So the plan today, guys, is just have a really general chat around your thoughts and my thoughts on Passive House in public buildings, essentially. But I thought where we might start is just a quick introduction or a bit of an overview, probably, Pam, best coming from you. So I guess for the listeners who aren't aware of Passive House, you know, what is it and how does it differ from more conventional building standards?
Yeah, so the sort of pure Passive House have a set number of principles, including things like overall heating and carbon loading have got to be low, below a certain value. You've got to have very high levels of air tightness. You're looking at below 0.6 air changes per hour for your buildings. Looking at sort of low U values, so looking at how the fabric performs in itself. It's a common misconception, I think, that it's always got to be an MVHR, like a mechanical heat and ventilation recovery system used with it. That's not always the case, although in a lot of cases that is implemented. It doesn't always have to be mechanical, but you obviously have to look at the building holistically, what all goes in together. But it's very much focusing on energy efficiency, low carbon use, using things like solar gains to help heat the building, orientation and purging, etc., to cool it and things like that. So it's really just making buildings as energy efficient as possible, but taking it a step further and doing a lot of things like modelling in PHPP, which is their own software, similar to SAP, but it's really good because it takes in all the ducting and cabling. And actually, it's just a really good way of ensuring an exceptionally high level of performance, because it's very difficult to quickly swap out products. So, you know, once you've sort of decided on your spec, that's what you stick with. So everybody knows that you just can't sort of go into the merchants and see what's on special that week and substitute it. So it's quite tightly controlled, which leaves, you know, a very high level of building at the end of it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it requires minimum energy input. Mm-hmm. There still might be some.
Yeah.
You see a lot of Passive House houses, self-build projects, and they might have a electric heater in the downstairs room on for a very short period of time to heat the whole house. Absolutely. It's about retaining that heat and reducing those energy bills and carbon consumption as well.
Mm-hmm. And Adam, I mean, in terms of Passive House, is it still quite niche in the UK? Are you seeing it building momentum generally?
No, I think there's a bit of a misconception that it's kind of only a self-build sort of project, one-off houses. But no, we're seeing a lot more now venture into big commercial projects. So it all sort of started with St. Sidwell's Point, the world's first Passive House leisure centre in Exeter. And now we're seeing Passive House high rises in London, Passive House schools up in Scotland. I think new builds going forward in Scotland are going to be passive house standard some variation of it.
Yeah, the 23rd of October was the first cut-off point for the first consultation in adopting a Scottish passive house type solution to all new builds in Scotland. So it'll be interesting to move forward on the following stages and see what comes and develops from that.
And that's the 23rd of October
2024 is the first day of or was the cut-off point for that stage one analysis. So you know, they'll take that, develop it, and work on, you know, continue to work on the policy, but it's definitely something at the forefront of everything.
We've already seen though some projects take that step already, especially the schools. We're seeing passive house standards mainly across Scotland and also other parts of the UK. And it's interesting, my wife is a teacher and schools are just always cold, she's especially during the winter. I remember it growing up and it's not changed, she tells me. So yeah, it's quite important that, you know, we have a comfortable indoor environment for learning. And I think you know, the cost of heating a lot of these schools is very, very expensive, very difficult. So the push towards that passive house standard is kind of crucial in education.
I remember being at school and it was either one of extremes. It was either freezing cold or so hot that you couldn't concentrate. But it was because it was regulated centrally, which, you know, is fine. But a school in Blairgowrie might not be as cold as a school in Rannoch, for example, you know, in the Highlands, for those who are not Scottish, you know, where it's a lot more extreme. So I think, you know, the control locally, and you're right, Adam, we're being involved in a lot of education buildings in Scotland that are going up as passive houses, and they're phenomenal buildings.
Yeah.
Absolutely superb.
I think going back to your original point as well, Kira, I think there was a misconception, that passive house is a box, because it's very simple to create a lot of those standards in a box, very rectangular, straight walls. We are now seeing those designs be very innovative and curved walls, high rises, and really push the design. So they're becoming a lot more interesting on these projects. So it doesn't always just have to be a box, although that tends to be the more simpler way of designing passive house and reducing the chances of errors.
I think that's only going to develop though, isn't it? That design philosophy and ability, as people get more used to building with it and achieving those levels, you know, it's going to be the sky's the limit, you know, with what you can produce.
Yeah.
So it could be quite exciting over the next few years. What passive house designs come out.
Definitely. And even, I think modular is a great solution for passive house standards. You can make a box airtight, very a lot simpler than having to do a whole big building on site. So yeah. I see that as a big solution.
But also elements of that, it doesn't have to be full modules. So one of the sites that we've been involved in a school, they've done a lot of the prefabrication of the sheathing panels off-site with the application of Raptite and then joint on site. So it means that you've got a building that's coming on board quite airtight straight away without the additional works on site.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can modify it for location and exposure as well, which is important.
I think it's quite important to kind of clarify. A lot of the principles that I've always been building practices and are in place. Achieving air tightness is nothing new.
Yeah.
It's getting down to those lower performances and how we do that. So the same with insulation levels. We've always added insulation to our building. It's just getting it to substantial performances within the design.
Yeah, I think you're right there, Adam. And it's also on the controlling of it. I mean, we talked to Robertsons in one of our webinars last year, I think it was 2023, where we talked about the education sector. And the really interesting thing, and it was also St Sidwell's as well, and it was like the passports, the training that went in to give the workers on site the tools and the tracking. This is golden thread, isn't it? It sort of tracks through quality assurances, making sure best practice is adhered to. And there's some really exciting stuff coming in from that side of things, which I think the whole of the building industry and other industries can certainly learn from.
Definitely. We find one of the biggest challenges on sites to achieving these performances is the different contractors not communicating and working together. So you have a drywall contractor do their section and then electrician and a plumber come in and do their bit, which might compromise the quality of what the drywall contractor has done. So we're certainly seeing that on these passive house projects, that communication, that training across the sites is where that improvement of performances is coming from.
Definitely.
So if we can come on to perhaps some of the cost implications, I mean, what are your thoughts on the cost implications of building to Passive House standards? I mean, particularly when it comes to public sector, which we know is quite a big topic at the moment. Anyway, do we have a feel for, you know, cost versus energy savings, for example, long term?
I think it's true that in some cases the costs are perceived to be higher. I think that's maybe more so when you're looking at domestic. I think when you're looking at larger scales, there's always going to be costs in the public sector in these large commercial buildings. But I actually think that in this day and age, that will be very, very quickly absorbed by the cost of heating.
Yeah.
The cost of water supply, the cost of cooling, you know, it's actually going to be absorbed and made back very rapidly.
Yeah. It's going to offset it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is actually budgeting for your project with the ever-changing material prices. And that's what's becoming the challenge, especially with the amount of materials you're going to buy and the thicknesses of materials. A lot of these products as well might be specially made because they're not standard sizes and materials. So that can also influence the costing of things. But as we see more and more projects, they will become standard sizes and standard specification of products. So that will also drive the cost to be better in that way. And the great thing about the construction industry is the innovation as well.
Yeah.
And everyone will be looking at the passive house design and how to make it simpler. Mm-hmm. That's what we did with Raptite. You know, making a membrane self-adhesive yet vapor permeable, moving your airtight line to the external to get you the best chance of achieving passive house standards. And it was a big part of the air tightness strategy within St. Sidwell's Point. Mm-hmm. And many other passive house projects now across the country.
I think there's a lot of focus on costs, but actually even if you don't go down the passive route, you're still having to put those reductions in carbon footprint, those higher levels of insulation and air tightness in anyway. So, you know, that gap is closing, ever closing, and I think soon it's going to be negligible.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Just coming on to sort of, I mean, one of the things that I would like to see is more sort of community involvement and community engagement in terms of, you know, community feedback to helping shape and enhance the passive house designs for public buildings. And I'm just wondering, I mean, what kind of strategies do we think might be used to help educate the public about the benefits of passive house?
That's a good question.
Do
the public understand passive house? Probably not. If you were to say, oh, this school down the road is passive house, would people understand that? So there's certainly an education gap there that can be filled.
Well, I mean, I think if we could incorporate it into a community's overall sustainability goals, because what we do have now is a next generation of people who I think are much more interested in climate change and sustainability. And then they have this big public building going up in their local area, and there doesn't seem to be a ton of engagement. So perhaps it's just, you know, an education piece that we are going in and talking to these schools, not we, I mean, or well, maybe we, who knows, but the people are going to educate and involve, the involvement of the local community.
I think I've certainly seen that with one of the big local ones in Perth, Riverside School, I think it's called, and they did a lot where they actually engaged with the kids that were going to be using it. You know, they got them on site, they talked them through it, they did energy performance, you know, talks and things like that. I've seen in other situations, I was at a conference just a couple of weeks ago where, although it was housing, it was public sector, they were talking a lot about the sort of the social value and engagement with customers. And, you know, that perception and that ability to speak to people during the process and actually having them understand the process actually meant that they had some amazingly positive feedback at the end of it. You know, we've gone through retrofit, it's been horrendous, this was just so brilliant. There's a lot of social value and a lot of feeding back from these big developers into the community. So I think we are seeing more of it, but I think there's a wider net to catch that. It's all very well speaking to the people that are using the building. So sort of saying, right, kids, you're going to be moving into this wonderful building that's X, Y, and Z. But I think in terms of getting people on board with Passive House, I think there is a lot of education, and that could come through, there's a lot of things like local plans and I can't think what the correct terminology for it, but there's a lot more engagement with the public in what local areas are wanting, you know. So Blairgowrie, where we are, they're having those discussions at the moment, you know, the sort of the plans for the town, and that's where this sort of, these sorts of conversations can be held. And perhaps we need to stop looking at, you know, Homes of the Year and some of the what makes a building look beautiful, and actually get some programmes out there of what makes a building good, you know, from a fabric.
I think we can also simplify a lot of the things that we talk about and do with projects. EPC ratings, for example, very simple. Homeowners understand. Yeah. It's graded A to F, I want to say.
It goes down to G&H.
G&H.
Not with Procter products.
Not these days, you can't really.
Yeah. But that matrix makes it very simple for people to understand. Yeah. And I think we can do something similar with Passive House. So when you're going into these projects, you can easily see and understand. And when you're looking at them online, what actually that means. There's more we can do there to simplify it.
I think as well, the Passive House approach will often use the kind of concept of local, sustainable, in terms of both materials and the workforce that they're using. So on these buildings, and quite a lot of the time. Yeah. So again, I think that further minimises the environmental impact, which we tend to think of Passive House as a high end, you know, something for self-builders. But I think, again, coming into the sort of community approach and the carbon footprint that building actually creates, even the energy efficiency aside, and just in terms of the construction of it, they tend to often try, if they can, it's not always possible to source locally in terms of materials and labour, but you know, that's often a first point of call.
Absolutely.
Anything to add, Adam?
No, I was gonna say, I think it's also, these projects are quite exciting. It might just be me being a bit of a construction nerd, but I think that the levels of detail they go to in the design process, I mean, some of the stuff with St. Sidwell's Point still goes over my head, but every fixing is analysed, the south-facing windows to heat the pool, all that level of detail, I think, is quite phenomenal to think about. And it's great having these projects documented for the public and everyone to actually see. A lot of buildings go up and you don't know much about them, but with these projects you do get more through the whole process, and I find it quite interesting.
Yeah, I agree. And what about the challenges then? So you talked us briefly through some of the principles of Passive House, but I believe there's still an element of specialist training for, you know, architects to have these projects Passive House accredited. There's a lot of expertise that goes into it, certainly in our experience of dealing with some of the designers and the people that are delivering the projects on the Passive House side of things. Is there a bit of a barrier there?
I think it was maybe perceived as a barrier, but I also feel that the way the business has moved, certainly within the last sort of 10 to 15 years, there is a lot more, or there are a lot more architects and designers out there with Passive House credentials who are designing to Passive House standards. There's a greater public knowledge on low carbon buildings and types, so there is the knowledge. I think it is obviously being taught as well, but a lot of it is self-taught. The Passive House Institute is doing a huge amount of work in that education sector with conferences and training courses, etc. So there is a knowledge, but that's not a bad thing. I think having that knowledge and training and striving for these standards and having a better, more analytical design at the start, it takes away the ambiguity when it actually comes to site. Yeah, it can mean, you know, if something goes wrong on site, it's a bit of a panic, how can we fix this properly? But actually, I think in reality, the problems when they get to site are fewer and easier to remedy because it has been so well thought out.
So well planned.
And looked out and planned. It does mean that people have to upskill, but you upskill somebody for one project, they carry those skills throughout their life. So, you know, it's like a reverse pyramid scheme, or it's like a pyramid scheme, isn't it? You know, one person starts with it, and all of a sudden, before you know it, 5 years down the line, 40, 50, 60, hundreds of people know about it. So
there's also, we talk about passive house and the standard and going for the full accreditation. It is a very complex process, but a lot of architects, designers do just look at it as a guideline. One of our most popular CPDs is our passive house CPD, because a lot of people are interested in the principles and everything behind passive house, even if they're not going for the full accreditation. Yeah. I think you've got a bit of experience with that, Kira, yourself.
I do, yeah. We built our house to passive house principles, so we didn't go to the full certification. And I think what we are seeing is, you know, passive house principles are being integrated into building codes and public sector standards. So it is almost, you know, encouraging wider adoption without the official stamp.
Yeah, and I think we also have to remember that passive house isn't just applicable for new builds. So you've got Enerfit standards, so they're the Passive House Institute's parameters around refurbishing. So you've got public buildings that are there that can be retrofitted to close to passive house standards, or you know, so you're maximizing the efficiency in you know, I think we've got some like 50% of the buildings that are standing now are our housing stock moving forward, or our building stock moving forward. So to be able to sort of say, right, okay, how can we take this old building and make it more energy efficient, make it more carbon friendly, minimise the impact? It's got to be done.
Yeah, I think it's good to clarify the Enerfit standard is like passive house standard, but a bit more relaxed, because you have some more constraints within passive house, within a retrofit of an older building, and more challenges. So it's to make it more feasible to actually achieve those levels of performances. But it's a good point that, you know, we've got a huge amount of existing buildings that need upgrading and improving, and they're going to have greater gains than improving some of the new builds, because they're already built to good standards. So a big focus on that going forward in the industry.
What I like about the passive house standard side of things as well is that it's global. So you can have, you know, a library in New York built to the same principles as a school in Scotland, and you can all learn from each other. Like, it's so interesting. I do think that even though the certification accreditation is quite rigorous and it is quite complicated, it really does show that commitment to long-term sustainability and energy efficiency. So it's a good it's a good route, I feel, that we're taking, certainly in Scotland at the moment.
Yeah. I think so. I was going to say, in the sort of the 20 plus years I've been here, you know, we've always talked about fabric first. And I do think that the rigors of passive house does put a lot of emphasis on that fabric first principles and making sure that we build it right.
Yeah. It started all in Germany, didn't it, with Dr. Wolfgang Feist and Bo Adamson, was it? I think. And they set the kind of principles of passive house together, and then the Institute, and it kind of quickly expanded in early 2000s from projects in Germany to projects all over the world, and of all varying sizes and challenges. And it's great to see design being pushed.
And we're seeing it's just exponential now.
Yeah,
you know, it's passive house used to be once every couple of months you would maybe get an inquiry, and it's, you know, you're talking about it on a much more regular basis. We used to get excited where it was like once a year.
I know. I mean, in the scheme of things, it's not been around that long.
No, it's
really
not.
Properly implemented in the 90s, talked about in the 80s. I think that was just down to the oil crisis. So because of the oil crisis, people were needing to look for more efficient ways to have these buildings functioning.
And here we are exactly in exactly the same situation now.
Even in the Middle East, where we see that there's an abundance of raw materials, even they're looking at ways to improve the performances of their buildings for a reverse reason for what we look at it for. Obviously they're using air conditioning systems to cool the inside of their buildings, but to run those all the time is quite a lot. So they're looking at the standards for reverse option, really, which is quite interesting. So we're seeing a lot of that. Yeah, it was interesting. I've been working with a design and build contractor down in London on a huge apartment block, passive house standard. Their first time doing passive house, build apartment blocks all the time. I spoke to them the other day and they said, we're going to copy and paste this for the next job. So it's great to hear that. It's not just a one-off venture. People are now going, we'll do it again and again.
And I think that's it. It's like taking that and going, that worked. Let's move it into, so it's that continuity. And then if you're bringing the same people to build, they go, we know this from last time. So again, you're just continuing to improve that knowledge. and that strength.
And the innovation. I mean, on St. Isidore's Point, one of the challenges was wind washing and thermal bypass. And there was a lot of question about the additional membrane over the face of the insulation. It was specced in and out a number of times, and how to actually install it and everything. And at the time, we only had one fire rated solution on Fire Shield. But since then, we've innovated and now got ProBreathe, which is more suitable option, I would say, for that application. And I'm sure other companies working on passive house projects have done similar innovation from what they've learned.
Mm-hmm. And did that, I mean, one thing we haven't really talked about, you mentioned wind washing there, it made me think of the environmental factors. These buildings are taking into consideration location, you know, solar gain, overheating, presumably, you know, so it's quite interesting how it fits in with the external environmental factors when you're planning and delivering these buildings, because it must be a huge factor.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that can actually lead to some quite exciting designs and how these buildings actually look within their location. You know, it kind of works with the environment rather than Mars against, you know, jars against it.
Yeah, definitely. We also see it in like Ministry of Defence. A lot of their barracks go sort of passive house standard, and they have other challenges, bomb resistance and bullet resistant testing to do. So they've got certain sort of materials and ways they need to build, and then trying to implement the passive house standards into that is also another challenge, but they're being able to do it even with that. And it's great to see that drive within that sector as well.
Interesting indeed. Yeah. So, any final thoughts around... Let's try and frame this as a question. What advice do we have for local government aiming to implement passive house standards in their building practices?
I think it's not something to be scared of. I think it's nothing that is alien to the industry now. I think we're very prepared to go that step to passive house now, and people are making that step, and there's no reason kind of why not to anymore. So I think, you know, let's explore it and give it a go on more projects.
Yeah, I think it's a case of not being nervous. I appreciate a lot of these buildings are very much controlled by funding, so that councils that are wanting to invest in passive house buildings are worried that if what they've got on site doesn't achieve it, what's going to happen to future funding for future public buildings? And I think, you know, it's engaging with designers, with your guys on site, with everybody involved in the design and build process, and just keeping those dialogues open and actually trusting the process and trusting the products that you use, and make sure that you pick the right products that will give you your air tightness with a margin of error.
Yeah.
You know, so that you can actually just sort of sit back and go, we can trust this to work.
And even if you can't fund going full passive house, use the principles as guidelines, and work with the suppliers and the contractors to improve that performance gap. Because a lot of that isn't going to cost much money. It is about training and education, which suppliers are supportive of. Get them involved in your projects. And that's what we're seeing much more of, is we're getting a lot more hands-on with a lot of our projects. So even if you can't fund the full passive house standard, there's still principles that could be taken from it.
And the exciting thing is it's causing us to innovate.
Yes.
In what we can provide and what we can help.
Yeah.
Just on the funding side, I would say as well, you know, make sure the research is done in terms of the incentives and the grants that are available for these type of public buildings that meet or exceed passive house standards. There's so many grants, government grants available for these type of projects. It's fantastic, and I think that's only going to improve in the years to come.
Definitely.
I would agree.
Okay, well, thank you both. That was a really interesting discussion we've had this morning on our Proctor podcast. Thank you to our listeners. I hope you enjoyed it. There will be a whole second season of these coming. So we will be recording these in the coming months as and when we find interesting topics. So please join us again. And thank you. Thank you both. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.